Campus FM jippreżenta Hekk Nafu. Sensiela li matula niltaqgħu ma' personalitajiet ewlenin Maltin mingħajnejn il-ħbieb tagħhom. Preżentazzjoni u produzzjoni Sergio Grech. Nsemmilkom nilqakom għall-programm ieħor minn din is-sensiela tagħna. Illum xtaqt nitkellem ftit dwar l-isqof Nicole Kauki li żgurwa personalità li ħalla wkoll impatt fl-istorja ta' pajjiżna. L-isqof Kauki twilet l-arb fl-1929 ġie ordinat saċerdot fl-1952 inħatar kappillan tal-Fontana fl-1956 għallem ukoll diversi suġġetti s-seminarju ta' Għawdex bħall-filosofija, soċjoloġija kif ukoll il-lingwa Taljana. Fl-1967 inħatar isqof awżiljarju ta' Monsignor Giuseppe Pace mbagħad beda jmexxi djoteċi ta' Għawdex fis-sena 72. Baqa' dej sas-sena 2005 meta mbagħad inħatar isqof ta' Għawdex Monsignor Mario Grech miet 5-6 snin wara ta' 81 sena fis-sena 2010. Biex nesplora ftit dan is-suġġett, didint miegħi lill-Dr. Steve Mallia li ta' fuq mill-background qawwi tal-ġurnaliżmu, naf li jew kien qrib ukoll ta' Monsignor Kauki u insomma, ħaħa nippruvaw noħolqu stampa ta' dan il-karattru fil-fema tiegħu wieħed mill-aktar ukoll interessanti li ħarġu minn Għawdex fi żmienna. Steve, thanks for attending this interview. When did you first meet Monsignor Kauki?
I met him quite late in his life. I mean, in 2000 and in the year 2000, basically, there was a big controversy. I mean, not just in Malta, but worldwide about a Siamese twins case, about the separation of a Siamese twins case. I was working at the Times of Malta at the time, and I wanted to obviously interview. The church had taken a very, very strong stand in this regard, and I wanted to conduct an interview with the Bishop of Gozo, who was quite vociferous. So I asked the courier if I could interview the Bishop of Gozo, and the answer was no. I asked again, and then I saw him on television. I said, look, I said, we really should have an interview with the Bishop. And then they said, okay. So I went up to Gozo. I'd never met Monsignor Kauki at all. And I was sat in the waiting room for 2 hours waiting for him because he had lots of people to see in the meantime. And one of his assistants at the time kept coming up to me and asking, will you give him the questions for the interview? And I was saying no. And this sort of happened repeatedly.
You were strict on
I was very strict about that. And then anyway, eventually, after 2 hours, sort of, I walked in there. I found him there, and I intended the interview to be very quite aggressive because some of the church's positions seemed a bit rigid at the time. But then, within a few minutes of the interview, he went in a direction that I wasn't quite expecting. You know, which is an interviewer sort of really starts to make you think on your feet. And then it got worse for me because after about 15 minutes, he started sort of cracking jokes. And I thought, not only am I not managing to sort of bludgeon this individual, but he's actually enjoying it, you know. And so the interview continued. The interview was a very, very candid interview, you know, full of good exchanges. He introduced some of these jokes. And I got a very good impression of this person by the time the interview ended.
Mm-hmm. And this was followed by a number of other encounters, actually.
Yes, I mean, straight after this interview ended, I mean, he watched me turn off the tape recorder and he said to me immediately, he said, look, he said, you've just interviewed me about this Gozerton couple who are in England at the moment, etc. He says, I haven't met them for a very long time. In fact, I don't even know what's going on with them. And he said to me, if you find out something, can you just inform me privately as to what's going on, because I don't really know, which again took me by surprise. I said, okay. So I did this. And then he said to me, look, if you come to Gozo, just drop by, you know, have a chat and that sort of thing. So contact kind of started from there. And I found him to be a very engaging personality. He was always very frank, quite open. I think he made a decision. He wasn't a very trusting person on the whole. But I think if he made that decision to try, kind of be, you know, trust somebody, then he could become quite trusting. Mm.
Was he easy to interview?
Yes, in the sense that he was very open. You know, he was very candid. If anything, he could get himself into trouble at times in an interview because he would be so candid. So from that point of view, and he had a lot of substance, and he talked the right language. He didn't talk in sort of what I used to describe, you know, as churchy language, which used to make him laugh when I used that term. He used to talk, you know, simple language that people understood, and I think that made him very easy to interview, and he, you know, he became very, very accessible.
And I think he was an ordinary man, in fact.
I think he was ordinary and extraordinary. I think he's one of the brightest minds I've ever met in my life.
Mm.
And it's incredible, you know, that such a bright mind can emerge from such a tiny village in Gojo. But that's how he was. I mean, he could recount stories that went back years. He could react to situations incredibly quickly. I mean, he had a very sharp tongue when he had an anecdote for everything. He spoke, you know, different languages. He was incredibly well read, in the sense, you know, he knew all of Shakespeare. He knew much of literature. He knew heavily about opera. And in fact, if you ever approached his rooms in the seminary, you know, you could often hear opera sort of blaring out before you reached his door. And yet he lived in two rooms in the seminary. Mm. I mean, this was a guy that could have lived
in a palace or
yes. I mean, you know, in much better accommodation. And he chose to spend all his bishopric living in two rooms in the seminary. And, you know, the only other place he would end up going would be the family home, which is next to the church in Arp.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he was very simple in his needs. I mean, he didn't care about the way he dressed. In fact, he always wore a cassock, and he always joked that he wore this so he could cover up all the horrible things that were sort of underneath. And what he wore underneath most often was like a shirt and a pair of shorts, you know. So he was very simple. He was very simple in his tastes. He wasn't materialistic at all. I mean, the bishop's ring he wore was a sort of old, valueless ring. And even the cross he wore, it was the simplest thing. And people used to give him more valuable things, and he wouldn't wear them.
Mm. And of course, he was well-read, especially in the social teachings of the church. It was one of his favorite areas.
Absolutely. I mean, he went to the Gregorian University in Rome, and he chose to study sociology and philosophy, as opposed to canon law. Now, this, in my opinion, I mean, he had a brilliant mind, and he could have had a very easily forensic legal mind. But I think I remember him telling me that the previous bishop had told him that there was a need for somebody in that sphere. And I also think that although he could have easily been a canon lawyer, I think his mind was very much focused on that, and his mind was very much focused on people. I mean, that's something, a very, very strong sort of quality that he had. He was very concerned about people and wanted to help people as much as he could.
Mm-hmm. Would you describe him as a conservative person? Or was the press that gave that impression?
Again, I think it's a question of, yes, he was. I mean, in church matters, yes, he was conservative. He promoted the views of the church, which can be seen conservative. I remember once somebody described him as ultra-conservative, and he said, well, can't they just call me conservative? Do they have to say ultra-conservative? Having said that, I think he first became a bishop in 1967, as you mentioned, and then proper bishop of Gojo in 1972. I think if you look at the things he did in that period, especially at the beginning and continued with, I think you'll call him anything but conservative. I think he was quite revolutionary in many of the social aspects that he introduced into Gojo. I mean, he set up so many institutions, came up with so many new ideas. He was interested in journalism himself because once upon a time he used to write, he used to edit the Higher Faudish, so he was interested in that. And he was always interested in changing and reform, and he wanted to go forward all the time. So, yes, he was conservative in church matters, but on the other hand, he was very innovative, and he also was a great believer in communication and the media.
Mm. Was he a politician too in
Oh, yes.
In some of his actions, I mean, I
think it's unavoidable to be in certain positions and not, you know, wear a political hat. So I think he was pretty capable of doing that. And plus, he was Gozerton. And as we all know, the Gozertons can be very quiet at times and, you know, so, yes, inevitably he had to be a politician.
I think he was also proud of his Gozertin part of his character. I mean,
he was immensely proud. I mean, Gozo for him, two things mattered to him. One was Gozo, the other one was the church. And beyond that, he didn't really care about much, you know, at all. And he pursued them very, very vigorously. He always sought to promote Gozo wherever he could. And he encouraged other people to do so. He encouraged me to do so, for example. You know, I was at the newspaper, and he was always saying to me, Gozo's not getting enough attention. Can you try and, you know, give it more attention, et cetera, et cetera. So, and also, as I mentioned, I mean, the number of social structures that he set up in Gozo, I think, is very impressive.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but he also helped the Gozertons people in need of social housing and so on.
Yes, I mean, and this, again, started very early on, which is why, you know, conservative or revolutionary. In 1972, for example, when he just become the actual bishop, he came up with a scheme whereby he sold... the church in Gozo sold plots. I think it started off with 50 plots, and I think it was on the outskirts of Victoria at the time, for very, very low prices. But not only did it do that to help people, you know, that couldn't afford housing, it also brokered an agreement with Barclays Bank at the time, who had a presence, to make sure that those people not only bought cheaply, but also could obtain loans to buy these properties cheaply. So, and that was just the beginning, apart from all the work he did, you know, to set up to help disabled people, underprivileged. I mean, so much. And obviously, he also was very concerned about education. He was aware that there was a need to really push on education, because he believed that education was the key to everything. I mean, even in his own priests, for example, he introduced a requirement in the training of priests in Gozo, whereby they had to spend a year abroad. And he saw this as, you know, vital to their formation, because he recognized that as much as he loved Gozo, how insular Gozo could be, and how restricted they might have been in certain things. So he, to address that, he wanted them to go abroad before coming back.
Which period would you consider as the most easy, let's put it like this, and of course, the most tense?
I think it ebbed and flowed, obviously. Certainly, the periods that caused him most heartache, especially when there were trouble between the two Victoria parishes, that's something that started off with him as soon as he became bishop. In fact, they didn't celebrate one of the feasts for sort of several years, even when he was appointed bishop, he was booed by you know, a few people as he was walking up the stairs, and that's something that he never forgot. Something that always, you know, always kind of hurt him, something he never intended. So I think, and those issues persisted.
He kept talking about these issues,
yes,
even in his older age?
Exactly. And these issues never really, you know, occasionally they'd go away for a bit and then they'd come back. So I think if you have to say to me what probably hurt him the most and what he found most difficult was trying to deal with those issues. And He had a tendency just to want to see people happy, and he always believed that education would eventually lead to that. And he was quite disappointed, I think, that it didn't, even by the time he left.
What sort of subjects did you cover during your meetings?
I mean, also he was interested in so many things. I mean, he was very interested in what was going on in the country and further afield from the country. So, you know, he was very keen to talk about politics. He wanted always to know what my input was on the political situation at a given time or on certain issues. I mean, I'll just give you one example. I remember when the EU referendum was coming up in 2003, and obviously Malta was very, very polarised, and the opposition leader at the time was very much against. And he was trying to obtain a book by an author who was totally against the EU, and he couldn't obtain the book. And he told me, can you get this book for me? And I managed to get it. Amazon had just sort of come into being. And I managed to get him the book at the time. And he read it, I mean, from cover to cover. This guy read like few people I've ever seen. You know, he used to read. He was a voracious reader. And so he studied situations very carefully. And he could talk about all sorts of things. So talking to him was easy, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And plus, I mean, he was a great storyteller. So, you know, I started off... something that got me very close to him in 2002, he went to Brazil. It was the 50th anniversary of his priesthood. And I asked him, I said, look, at some point, would it be okay with you if I join you? He was seeing Gozatan priests, and he said, yes. And we went to Brazil, and we spent a long time there sort of together in an environment that was unfamiliar, which was good, you know, and traveling on planes and mm-hmm. cars and things. And during that visit, I learned a great deal about him, but also we resolved two things. One, that it would be a good idea for him to start communicating his thoughts. So I didn't take much persuading, but I suggested to him that he starts writing in the newspaper, and he agreed to that readily. The other, he was very overweight, and I said to him, you have to do some exercise. And so we resolved that once a week we would go for a walk. And it was during those walks, you know, where you could converse about many things, but sometimes he'd go to a place in Gozo that he hadn't been to in years, so he'd have a story about that.
Who chatted most in these encounters?
I think it depended on what was going on. I mean, if you just let him talk, he could talk by himself. He had so many stories, and he could remember them so easily that he could do that. But obviously, if you know, I initiated conversation on many things, and I gave him a lot of opinions, and even on opinions on church matters, for example, that I would. But it was just private discussion; it wasn't like, you know, advice or anything. Mm-hmm. But obviously, if issues were going on, we kind of discussed them.
Exchange of ideas. Was he interested in writing an autobiography?
yes, is the answer. It was something I was supposed to get involved with him doing at some point. Then I got caught up, unfortunately, with some of the things. So it stalled me heavily. And in fact, I did sit down with him on a few occasions, and we did record a few conversations, the beginnings sort of intended for that purpose. But unfortunately, it didn't come to pass. What he did start doing then in 2009, a year before he died, he decided, okay, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write an autobiography. So he wrote about 12,000 words that was just a skeleton of an autobiography. Unfortunately, it didn't get further because then he passed away.
Mm. Is the document still available? I mean, is it still...
It was never made publicly available, and it's something he was typing himself. So, I mean, it's full of his typing errors and that sort of thing. And he was very much setting out the scene. But yes, I mean, I've seen this, and I have a copy of it.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell me about his relationship with the members of the priesthood? Was he easy to communicate with them, or he lived in a world of his own? I mean...
Maybe they can answer the question better than I can. I don't think he lived in a world of his own, put it that way. I think quite the opposite. I think his door was always open. I think it was one great strength that he had, that he was always in the courier and his door was always open. And even if he wasn't in the courier, people knew where he was. He was invariably in the seminary. And if people wanted to speak to him, I never know that he ever refused to speak to anybody. So, and, you know, he was always willing to discuss issues. And if there was a difficult issue, he might bring in an intermediary. He was always trying to find solutions, always.
Mm. As you said, he was an avid reader, but he was also a writer. I mean, he wrote, several tens of books.
Yes. I don't know how many. I mean, at one stage, I, among others, was trying to persuade him, as he was getting older, to move from his two rooms in the seminary, which weren't really very suitable for him, especially when he reached a certain age, and just to move to a parish centre that was where he'd be a bit more comfortable. He initially agreed to this. And so one thing we had to do was shift his books. And I logged his books as we were sort of, you know, shifting them, and there were 7,000. So that gives you an idea of how many books he had. And then you come across, you know, so many that he wrote himself. But apart from books, he wrote, you know, I mean, not just for the Times. I mean, he was still an avid contributor to Haya Foudish and many other things. And if someone asked him to write something, he would write. He enjoyed it very much.
And also the circular letters, I mean.
Yes.
And was there a particular area that he would not speak about it, or that he would not feel so comfortable to?
With me or
with me,
or
with you, or with others? I don't know.
No, I mean, with me, I think he was pretty much an open book. He spoke about. I'm not aware that he particularly wouldn't speak about a certain subject. I mean, having said that, you do reach a stage sometimes where you're a journalist and you know that, and he is a bishop and he knows that. And I remember very much, it was unspoken though, when it came to the succession, when he wanted to resign. I mean, he was forcing his resignation. And when it came, you know, to who was going to succeed him, that was a subject we did not discuss. And we didn't even discuss not to discuss it. It was just organic. It was just, well, I'm a journalist, so I'm going to have to do my work, you know. And he is the bishop. I know that he recommended three names. I have no idea who they are, and I never asked him because I thought it was unfair to ask him. So there always are certain boundaries. And in fact, when I came up with a story saying it was going to be Mario Grech, as it turned out to be, and he asked me afterwards, but how did you know? Because he didn't know.
Was he loved by his people?
I think he was, yes. I mean, I think everywhere he went, as I say, one great strength of his is that he was always very present. I mean, not just accessible to people, so people could come and see him at the office and, you know, without appointment. He was also in the parishes all the time, in the churches all the time. I mean, for him, functions were very, very important, and he would very rarely say no to a function. He would only say no if something clashed. He would always. And also he loved interacting with young people, so that was very important to him. You know, he liked being surrounded by young people.
Mm-hmm. He was a good communicator. I mean, we certainly agree on that point. But had he a good marketeer? I mean, I don't know if you understand because my point. Because sometimes the bishops tend to be unpopular with their flock.
I mean, I think on the whole he could communicate well. I think if he had a, you know, everyone has defects, and I think one of his defects would have been that he tried to please. Sometimes he tried to please everyone, and you cannot please everyone. He just wanted, you know, to fix situations, and sometimes situations aren't fixable. So, in certain circumstances, perhaps he wasn't a great communicator because he was trying to fix too many situations.
Mm. And he also used the dialect. I mean, it was something normal for him. It wasn't
the dialect as in
ARP and
yes. I mean, I think it depends. It depended how you found him. But yes, I mean that was. I mean, he was embarrassed once as a child. He used to do a lot of plays as a child. He was always like. Wanted to be on stage, you know, and that sort of thing. And I think he pronounced the word, which is in Maltese, is bip, bip, and everyone started laughing at him. And I think that's something that sort of remained consciously in his brain. But yes, I mean, he was from Arab. He was very proud that he was from Arab. So.
And even in his sermons, I mean, you could spot the dialect.
Yeah.
How would you rate him as a bishop? I mean, was he the right bishop at the right time?
I think yes. I mean, so on that point of view, I think when he became Bishop of Gozo, I think Gozo was very much in need of that kind of bishop. I think, you know, with all the reforms he introduced, with all the structures he set up. Personally, I think he stayed in Gozo too long, way too long.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had such capabilities that he could have. At some point, I think he made a mistake. I think he should, at some point he should have moved away from Gozo. He would have easily had that opportunity, and I think you know that's something that he could have done.
And go where? To Rome or?
Well, I mean, I know at one stage they asked him if he was interested in being Archbishop of Malta before Machiato was appointed to that role. He was approached by somebody at the time, and he said, "Well, I'm not really interested."
I was not interested.
I mean, he didn't, you know, he didn't push it. Let's put it that way. Mm. But yes, I mean, Rome could have been a very easy place for him. He became very close to Pope John Paul I. Because they used to attend conferences together, and Bishop Cauchi used to smoke cigars. He stopped then, you know, he didn't smoke for many years. And Pope John Paul I used to say to him, the cigars, you smoke the same cigars that my father smoked. And they became friends. So I think had Pope John Paul I not died after about a month or so, I think there would have been a possibility there that you actually might have ended up in Rome. But he was not a Roman courier man. So I think that conflict would have always been inside. He was a people man.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Archbishop Merci, and it seems that they had quite a good relationship, a good working relationship between them.
Well, I think they were very different people. Let's put it that way. You know, one was a bit outspoken, which was Cauchi was outspoken. Merci was not outspoken. Bishop Cauchi never wanted to upstage him. So he never did anything intentionally to upstage them. But what was very impressive about Machiato, when Bishop Cauchi was sick in hospital, and he spent about 3 weeks in hospital, Machiato was coming, I was going often, and Machiato was coming twice a day. And there you saw a bond that I hadn't seen between them ever before, and in many years.
Mm-hmm. Was he sick? Because we never knew of
No, he wasn't sick. He wasn't sick. No, it was just, he had a bit of a heart issue, but it suddenly deteriorated.
Steve, għanif u għonek, nir-ingrazzjak ħafna ta' din l-esperienza. Ovvjament kienet esperienza ħajja wkoll għaliex kif semmejna l-president tal-lum, Steve Mallia, kien jaf ukoll mill-qrib għal minnu fażi minn ħajtu lill-isqof Nicole Cauchi. Ringrazzja lil Carmelo Grech tal-bilanċ tekniku, niltaqgħu bħallum tmien tiegħek insemmilkom. Smajtu Hekk Nafu fuq Campus FM. Prezentazzjoni u produzzjoni Sergio Grech.